Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we are going to be talking about the fact that the Utah Inland Port Authority looked into a secretive rail rehabilitation proposal that sought to transport Western mined coal to the California coast. The legislation in Washington that aims to try to help save saline lakes in the West, including the Great Salt Lake. And later in the show, a retiring food writer reflects on her four decades of newspaper work. And joining me for this conversation here in studio, I've got Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley. Good morning, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, good morning, Roger.
Yeah, and then on the Zoom, we have Tribune government reporter Leah Larson. Thanks for being here, Leah.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
Of course. And Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. And welcome to you, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. A little bit later in the show, we will hear from Kathy Stevenson, who is retiring from the paper after 39 years. Stick around for that. And listeners, we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. You can tweet them to @KCPW, or you can call us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. We're going to start with you, Brian Maffley. You reported this week on a conference call, that took place earlier this year involving an employee of the Utah Inland Port Authority, a Utah coal industry representative, and then a couple of folks from, who were not from Utah, actually. What was this meeting all about, and who were the players here, Brian?
Yeah, this was a meeting about developing or rehabilitating an old rail line that hasn't been used in 30 years in Northern California, and it's called the North Coast Railroad, and it connects the Bay Area with about 250 miles to the north, a underutilized port at Humboldt Bay, where this town of Eureka. It's a huge bay. It's the second largest on the California coast, after the San Francisco Bay, of course, and there's some deep water shipping channels there, and lots of terminals that were built years ago to ship timber products. And so there's been a strong suspicion that the coal industry, which has had a lot of difficulty developing export terminals on the West Coast, were looking to this place. There's it's underutilized. There's a railroad that goes there. And so the problem with the railroad is it's not usable at the moment, and it probably won't be unless you spend $2.5 billion fixing it up. It goes through the northern part of it goes through very rugged terrain in the coastal mountains through the Eel River Canyon. And so this meeting that the Utah Inland Port Authority participated was to check out this proposal, hear what the proponents had to say about it, and how we learned about this whole story to begin with was some reporting from a little paper in Eureka, California called the Lost Coast Outpost. And a reporter named Ryan Harris kind of broke this story that some secretive company was trying to take over that rail line.
This is the North Coast Railroad Company.
Yeah. They're a newly formed company. No one knows who they are. They're disclosures don't provide any information about who they are or what their intent is. However, they filed paperwork with the Surface Transportation Board to thwart efforts in Northern California to rail bank the North Coast Railroad so it can be turned into a recreation trail. It's going to be called the Great Redwood Trail.
And this is a Rails to Trails initiative.
Yeah.
Just quickly here, before we go too far into the story, I mean, the big idea, I guess, here and maybe in this meeting, and we can get to the meeting, and I'm curious about how we know these details, aside from the reporting that was done by that paper.
Yeah.
The big idea here was to revive this rail line and then to use it to export coal, from coal mines on the Crow Nation, and I guess elsewhere in the West, through the California coast. How would Utah have been involved, or was that clear from this meeting?
Well, Utah has been extremely interested in exporting its coal for years, and it goes back to that proposal in Oakland. And what we've learned from that experience is that these proponents always hide behind front companies that seem to be locally controlled, minority controlled often. And in this case, it's the Wiat tribe, indigenous to Humboldt Bay. And they never say what they're going to export or move with this, their proposals. And so in a lot of these, so in this meeting involving the Utah Port Authority, Inland Port Authority, the word coal never comes up, but it didn't have to come up. There's only one commodity that's having trouble getting exported, and one commodity that can be produced in, you know, the volumes that would make a $2 billion rail rehab project sensible, and it's coal. There's the Western states are producing, they're overproducing it. There's nowhere to put it, and there's certainly demand for it in Japan, and they'll pay a premium for coal that comes from Utah because it's pretty good quality.
Yeah. One part of the big idea here was to get a tax incentive, or actually, I guess, a loan, a huge loan through a federal program, $1 billion loan. Can you just tell us about that?
Yeah. So how this when I was doing my reporting on it, I heard from folks at the Humboldt Bay Harbor District that someone from the Utah Inland Port Authority had called them to ask questions about how suitable that port would be for moving large volumes of, you know, mined minerals. Again, the word coal never comes up. And so when I learned that, I just sent a grammar request to the Port Authority asking for any kind of communication involved that had that mentioned Humboldt Bay. And a couple memos came back, and one of them described this meeting that occurred on March 16th, or phone conference call. And the people on the call were a guy from the Inland Port Authority named Chris Minton, who he only worked there for a few months. And then Brian Summers of the Utah Mining Association, the energy director for the Crow Nation, whose name is C.J. Stewart, or Conrad Stewart. And the Crow Nation is sitting on literally billions of tons of coal in the Powder River Basin, and they have a strong interest in getting exported. And Stewart has been among the most vocal proponents of coal exports, and describes efforts to stop those exports as a kind of an attack on the Crow people. And
right, you talked about weaponizing the Clean Water Act.
Yeah, and, exactly. Yeah, and then there was a representative of the Wiat tribe. I guess that was about everybody. It's five people total. Yeah.
People in California, after the reporting from that small paper, broke this story. More than a few are up in arms about the idea of there being a coal train coming to that coast, to that port. And among them is a state senator out there named Mike McGuire. You said that he was upset in your article, and he is the proponent behind the idea of making that big trail that you were talking about.
He's the leading champion of that proposal, and has secured millions of dollars in state appropriations to turn that rail line through Eel Canyon into a trail that will be, it'd probably be the longest rails-to-trail project in the United States when it gets completed. Yeah.
There are more than a few pieces of the story. I've been using a lot of past tense verbs here in describing this project because this is an idea that does not seem to be headed anywhere after all, at least not that we know of.
No, and frankly, there's something about it that's just like smells like a swindle. You know, I don't know how else to put it, but this company files this several weeks ago, filed paperwork with the Surface Transportation Board to block this campaign to, rail bank the North Coast Railroad, saying they have a $1.2 billion in financing lined up to rehabilitate the rail line and have, and the purpose would be to ship quote-unquote high volumes of freight traffic, bulk minerals, again, they don't say what, through the Humboldt Bay District. And so what Senator McGuire was so ticked off about was, here's this company sabotaging, these good faith proposals to reclaim that rail line without having any transparency. We don't know who they are. where their funding is, what they plan to ship. And the Wiat tribe has been very quiet about it until yesterday. They put out an announcement saying, you know, they're totally distancing themselves, saying we didn't know that coal was involved with this. We're not going to be participating in any way. And the Utah Inland Port Authority also has told us. They're not. They're saying, look, this project has no viability. We're not going to be involved.
There's this quote. Well, actually, before we go there, I'm kind of curious if you can answer something that occurred to me while you were describing this whole idea. Is, you know, you talked about the amount of coal that's on the Crow Nation. There's also this coal that's being overproduced, as you said, in the state of Utah. How does that coal, go from those specific places to this one trail line? How would that, you know, if that were to happen, how would that happen?
We have the rail infrastructure in Utah and in Colorado, Wyoming, Montana. It's there. We have to get it to the West Coast. It's just that all these proposals that have come along, like the big ones were Oakland and Longview, Washington, to develop export terminals specific to coal, they've gotten blocked by the local and state governments. And it's resulted in lots of lawsuits. And in the case of one company, Lighthouse Resources, which was behind the Longview project, they went bankrupt. And in the course of a lot of these bankruptcies, the Navajo Nation now has acquired a lot of those coal assets in the Powder River Basin. And again, so now we have the Crow and the Navajo are two of the largest owners of coal resources in the West.
Just as you mentioned, the Utah Inland Port Authority is trying very hard to distance themselves from this thing, and they say that, you know, that they were just looking into it. I want to read a statement that you got from Executive Director Jack Hedge, because it's just an interesting
one. It's kind of frustrating, man.
It says, in response to a Tribune reporter who is writing a story that falsely implies the Utah Inland Port Authority is pushing or has ever supported a project to ship coal from Utah to Asia, UIPA has no current or future plans to export coal from Humboldt Bay. We looked into it, and we did not find the project find it to be a project the Port Authority could be involved with. So that's the quote. Kind of a rebuke of your reporting, in advance of your reporting, and then a statement about the port not supporting coal from Utah to Asia, and then a statement saying that we looked into it. Now, but they don't want to be associated with it. It also sounds like they're saying that they won't be involved in any coal projects. Is that what they're saying?
Who knows what they're saying? I mean, I called up Jill Fleigar, the associate director of the Port Authority, saying, look, we're doing a story about this. We'd like to talk to you about what your intentions are. Instead, I get their outside publicist calling me, and then I get this response from Jack Hedge that is completely unresponsive to what we were asking. What we really want to know is, you know, is the Port Authority interested in facilitating the export of coal? This participation in this meeting certainly suggests that it is interested in helping export coal. And if that's the case, let's come clean with it. Exporting coal is inherently controversial. Mm-hmm. And that they were doing, quote unquote, due diligence on this project suggests that they're looking to participate in that, which is fine. I mean, that's kind of part of their mission, right? But let's just be honest about it. And so that's all I could get from Jack Hedge.
Yeah. Maybe it's the I'm looking at the quote again, and it says you're writing an article that falsely implies the Utah Inland Port is pushing or has ever supported a project to ship coal from Utah to Asia. UIPA has no current or future plans to export coal from Humboldt Bay.
Yeah. Getting involved in this project would not be smart. It's going to cost way too much money. Mm-hmm. There'll be way too much political pushback. So, has to be a truthful statement. But the bigger interest concern that I think people should have is, well, are you getting involved in the export of coal? And I think that would be a question, Jack Hedge. I'd love it if you could answer.
Hmm. Let's bring in the columnist, Robert Gerke, on this, because, Robert, the fact that people don't want coal mining to come through their communities or being shipped out of their communities on the California coast is a story that we keep seeing repeated over and over again. And then there's this meeting and the statements by the Inland Port Director. Honestly, Robert, I don't know what to think or what to ask you. Do you want to just give us your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, Brian kind of already touched on my thoughts on this, and And it basically comes down to, let's have some transparency. Let's have some honesty from the Inland Port Board. And if we hadn't seen this constant pattern of avoiding direct questions from the Inland Port Board since its inception, I think maybe we'd maybe trust them a little bit more. But look, if coal is viable, if it's something they plan to ship or be involved in a plan to ship, then, you know, say that and don't, you know, beat around the bush and issue these denials. The fact that they, you know, the fact that they did participate in these meetings shows that when they say that they never planned to do this, that's not true. And so, you know, they can't have it both ways, and they avoid and they dodge and they, you know, and they won't give a direct answer to direct questions, and, you know, put it on the table and let the public hash it out. That's what the process is supposed to be. But we've never seen that process in it, you know, of total transparency and public engagement through from the Inland Port Board since it was created. So this is just another, you know, chapter of its record of, you know, avoiding public accountability, public input, public transparency. And it's really disheartening. The plan itself seems like it's sort of a harebrained idea, but, you know, there are parties in the state who are desperate to try to ship Utah coal someplace because nobody wants it here. So it's one of these things that, you know, is there. I would be shocked if this is the last harebrained idea we see to try to get this coal to market. And you know, we just need transparency. The public needs to know what's going on, and you know, these secret meetings that are taking place and these sort of non-denial denials need to stop.
Yeah.
Brian, where does this story, I mean, the due diligence is what the Inland Port Authority said they were doing on this meeting. You know, they're having a meeting with somebody who, I guess, requested the meeting, or I'm not exactly certain what the due diligence was there, but where does this story go, the specific story of this rail line and Utah's involvement go from here?
Well, it's pretty clear that Utah's involvement is pretty minimal at this point. It's not clear if the Utah Mining Association is going to stick with it. What's happening now, I think, in part because of our reporting, where we learned from this memo that this company that's appears to be led by C.J. Stewart of the Crow Nation and a consultant named Justin White, W-I-G-H-T. I forgot to mention him. He's the consultant on the project who was in on this meeting. He's running this proposal, but no one knows really who he is or who he represents.
Right, he seems like a mysterious. From your reporting, he seems like a kind of mysterious character.
So he's telling the Port Authority that they're investigating getting $1 billion of loans from the U.S. Department of Transportation. So as a result of us reporting that, to Congress. Congress representatives from Northern California who represent that area yesterday sent a letter to the Interior the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, asking them to reject any proposal to fund the rehabilitation of the rail line.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And they're the local representatives for that area.
Yeah.
Brian, we have to head to a break here. Is there anything you want to add before we, I mean, to squeeze in just on this story before we head to a break?
Yeah. Well, I think there'll be proposals to export Utah coal. And the other logical spot for that would be Ensenada in Mexico.
Yeah. And Brian Maffley, Salt Lake Tribune, Public Lands and Environment reporter. You'll be watching that, I'm sure. Thank you for your reporting on this. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
And we're going to take a quick break on the show. When we come back, a bill in Congress to take action to protect salty bodies of water like the Great Salt Lake. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Leah Larson and Brian Maffley, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our live Friday morning Utah news wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or by tweeting those comments to @KCPW. And Leah Larson, we will go to you now. Leah, we know that the Great Salt Lake is imperiled. We know that it has hit a record low, but it turns out it's not the only saline lake in the West that is suffering. And just before we get to the legislative part of your reporting from this week, can you just tell us about some of those other lakes and maybe remind us why salty lakes are salty, if that's possible?
Yeah. So, yeah, Great Salt Lake gets a lot of the attention, but there are a lot of terminal salty lakes in the West. Mono Lake in California, Salton Sea in California, Lahontan Wetlands, Pyramid Lake in Nevada. So there are a bunch. And the reason they're salty is because, like I said, they're terminal, which means they have no outlet. The only way water leaves these lakes is through evaporation. And so when the water evaporates, it leaves behind minerals, and that's what makes them salty.
And then I guess another question might be before we get to the meat of your reporting is why do they matter? I think there are some people, maybe not as many as there used to be back in the day, but some who think that salty lakes are dead lakes or dead zones. And that's not the case, right?
No, not at all. Yes, they matter because they serve as important habitats for migrating birds, for one. And the Audubon Society has done a lot of studies on this where all these salty seas or salty lakes kind of serve as an interconnected web for migrating birds in the Western Hemisphere. So, you know, they'll stage it, maybe the Salton Sea in California, then move on to the Great Salt Lake and vice versa. They're all kind of connected that way. 10 million birds use the Great Salt Lake alone. And then the birds aside, maybe you're not a bird person, you don't care about birds, but Great Salt Lake actually is quite an economic engine for Utah.
Right.
$1.3 billion a year in mineral harvesting, in brine shrimp harvesting, and tourism. So they are pretty vital to the West.
You know, so as I said, as I mentioned in asking you those sort of precursor questions, is that there is an effort afoot. There's some new legislation that aims to try to help these salty lakes like the Great Salt Lake in the Great Basin and beyond. Who's behind this legislative push and what would it do?
Yeah, so Utah's own Representative Blake Moore introduced some legislation in the House. And what it would do is provide $5 million each year for 5 years for the U.S. Geological Survey to study these lakes and maybe come up with solutions about what to do with their decline. And I know, you know, $5 million or $25 million over 5 years doesn't sound a lot in the context of like a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. But I think it says a lot that at least some lawmakers are recognizing that this is a big enough issue that they're willing to throw money at it.
And so you've mentioned, I guess, throwing money at it and trying to find a way to address some of the problems that are being created, that these lakes are suffering. And I guess we should talk about why these lakes are suffering. The fundamental problem here is that there's not enough water in them, and there are reasons for why the water's not getting there. Is this effort, the $25 million you're talking about, would it, I don't know, put water back into these lakes in any way?
That is such a good question. So the federal government doesn't really have any control over that. Water and water rights are largely controlled by the states. And then the claims to those water rights are super local. You know, they're the farm that has the water rights, or, you know, the irrigation district, or the water district. So the federal government really can't mandate that water goes to Great Salt Lake. What they can do is provide data for it. So the state agencies, the water districts have information. They're equipped with information on what to do because, you know, every drop counts and everyone has a role to play.
There is, beyond the threat to wildlife that we've been discussing, you know, the migratory birds, for example, there is another threat lurking, Leah, that is in these lakes, not just in the Great Salt Lake, but maybe prominently so here. And this is a threat to people. Can you talk about that?
Yes. air quality. So once the lake recedes and it leaves behind these dry playas, these dry lake beds, they desiccate and they turn into dust, and that can cause a huge public health disaster. The classic example would be Lake Owens in California. Back in the 20s, when Los Angeles was growing pretty rapidly, they tapped the water in the Owens Valley, you know, hundreds of miles to the north, and they piped it to Los Angeles and dried up this terminal lake called Owens Lake. And it turned out to be one of the most costly environmental disasters in U.S. history. You can look at old archived news stories from like the 80s and 90s, where people who lived in that valley were having bloody noses and respiratory issues because all this dust was blowing off this dry lake bed. And they've, you know, the water consumers of Los Angeles have had to pay billions of dollars at this point in mitigating that.
Yeah, sort of a classic example of a dried up lake and what it can do, the Owens Lake. You know, we mentioned the bill in the House, I think. There's also a bill in the Senate by Senator Mitt Romney that has been introduced. Are they basically the same bill? And again, neither of them is going to ensure that water keeps going into these lakes. This is a way of studying what's happening to the lakes. And how long would those studies take place, I guess?
So Romney, you're right. He didn't introduce the bill in the Senate, but he's a co-sponsor, and the bills are pretty much identical. And the study in these bills would fund studies for 5 years.
Okay. And then in your article, you quote this guy, John Luft, with Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Program at the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. And he paints a pretty bleak picture of the lake today. And this is the Great Salt Lake that he's talking about. Can you just tell us sort of what he conveyed, Leah, about birds and even brine shrimp out of the Great Salt Lake and where we are right now?
Yeah, John Luft is like the boots on the ground of the Great Salt Lake. He and his team are out there like pretty much on a daily basis, just taking assessment of what's going on with the water, with salinity, with the brine shrimp, with the birds. So he is a guy to ask about what is the situation currently like. And when I called him last week, I mean, he seemed very troubled. Things are bleak, he said. They're not seeing nearly the amount of birds they're used to seeing. And then one thing that struck me is that even the brine shrimp that live in the lake, like these are pretty tough critters. They can put up with some pretty harsh extremes. I mean, they live in a salty lake, but he said that they are acting very strange. They're not reproducing. And if the brine shrimp aren't reproducing, that spells disaster for the birds who eat them. And also potentially the fishermen that harvest their cysts to ship all over. You know, if you've eaten a shrimp, if you've ordered like a shrimp scampi, odds are good that those shrimp were fed little shrimp from the Great Salt Lake. Wow. About 40% of the brine shrimp used for feeding
fish
that people that eat, come from the Great Salt Lake. So the brine shrimping starts today, actually. So we will see how the harvest goes.
And that's, I mean, you're talking about a sort of cascading effect if the brine shrimp aren't there and the foods can't get it. Maybe I'll bring in the news columnist here just for a quick moment, Leah, and then come back to you. And Robert Gerke, it's not as if the lake and the life that it supports is something that has living roots that will, you know, grow back in a better year when there's water again. I guess basically what I want to say is that if you wait too long and then try to fix it, it won't matter because, you know, the species won't be there anymore. It's sort of the story of everything on this planet. I'm expounding. What do you want to say, Robert Gerke?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as Leah pointed out, that we're seeing some very dire warning signs about the health and the future of the lake. And it's not a given that it would recover, like you mentioned. And so I think it makes a lot of sense to, you know, we probably should have started this process earlier, but we need to start taking a careful look at what we need to do to try to ensure that this habitat, this ecosystem can be sustained. And you know, there's no indication that the trend, the trajectory that we're on is going to get better on its own. So, you know, it's important that we have to take a hard look at it and, you know, rehabilitating it to the extent that we can is going to probably take some time and some money and some resources. And so let's get started on it now before it's too late.
Brian Maffley, do you have any, I mean, you cover public lands and environment here in the state. Any thoughts on just the dire state of the lake? I mean, again, as I said, you've got these, you've got like millions of years of evolution for these species to come into being, and then you spend a few years and there's no water left and they go away. I don't know.
Well, I feel like we need to stop blaming this on the drought, and this low water is due because of water diversions, and we even have more being proposed, and we have some tough decisions to make if we want to rescue this profoundly important ecosystem.
Yeah. Leah, what's happening with these pieces of legislation currently? I mean, are they making progress? Are they making headway? Is anything?
Since Congress has some bigger priorities right now. So no. But to Brian's point, I think that was a good point. You know, the state of Utah, Utah State University, did this study a couple of years ago that found that actually Great Salt Lake would be 11 feet higher, which is pretty significant when you got a shallow body of water like that. 11 feet higher, if not for human diversions.
Wow. I mean, that's a significant amount of, again, that's Leah Larson, government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And Leah, I really appreciate your reporting on this. I want to, just because we're going to save time for a recorded segment with retiring food and alcohol reporter Kathy Stevenson, we are going to cut the conversation short here and already turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And, you know, in case you missed it, stories. And Leah Larson, actually, maybe I'll stick with you and have you, if you're ready, have you start with your pick for underplayed story.
Okay. Yeah. My pick is that Snow Basin is finally, maybe, possibly getting a hotel. They announced plans to build a Club Med. And I've never stayed at a Club Med, so I don't know a lot about them. But apparently the idea is that you stay there for like a week at a time, and it's the only place you go. So I love Snow Basin, and it is a great place to visit. But I'm not sure what people are going to do for a week at a time at Snow Basin. But there it is.
Okay. Interesting pick from Leah Larson for Underplayed Story of the Week. We'll see what happens with occupancy there. Robert Gerke, let's go to you and your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
My underplayed story is a kind of a personal one, I guess. My friend Will Bagley, who is one of the most renowned Western historians of our generation, passed this week after a stroke. I got to know Will pretty well over the last 4 or 5 years. His book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre is a pinnacle of history writing. It's a ripping story too. And so you know, we're gonna miss Will, and we're gonna miss his smile, and we're gonna miss all the work he's done to tell the story of the West.
I mean, that's I think that's my pick, and might be Brian's as well.
Well, I'll move on to another story about someone who died before their time. Aaron Lowe, the Utah football player, cornerback, who was murdered by party crashers following the Washington State game this weekend. It's really sad. And Josh Newman and Alex Vejar, a really touching story in the paper today, or on the website, I should say. Kind of a tribute to Aaron's efforts to memorialize his friend and teammate, Ty Jordan, who had died the year before in an accidental shooting in that case. But it's a really great story, and I really urge everyone to read it.
Check it out at sltrib.com. I'm going to, just for my part, just riff off of Robert Gerke's pick and say that I got to interview Will Bagley a couple times myself and to hang out with him a few times. And he was a friend of a lot of people, including my dad, and a funny person with lots of tales to tell and so much knowledge in his head. And there's a lot of mourning going on for people like, you know, like Will Bagley and the athletes that... Both Ty Jordan and
Aaron Lowe.
Aaron Lowe, thank you. Yeah, that's all the time we have for on the show, and we've got to turn to a final segment with Kathy Stevenson. But I will just thank my guests today. We've got Brian Maffley, Robert Gerke, and Leah Larson, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm having a hard time with names today. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you, Roger.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you. Thanks.
Good weekend.
Yeah, you as well. We are actually going to take a quick break in the show, and then we will return with retiring Tribune reporter Kathy Stevenson and her recollections on 4 decades in the news business, the last 2 decades of which she spent covering food and alcohol. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we are going to turn to my conversation with Kathy Stevenson. And Kathy retired this week from the Tribune after a storied career covering a lot of things, but eventually landing on the food and alcohol beat. And I invited her into the studio for a kind of exit interview. Take a listen. Kathy Stevenson, you have retired from the Salt Lake Tribune after quite a while, the paper, 39 years.
I know.
And congratulations, first off. Let me just say that.
Thank you so much.
How did you get your start at the Tribune? Were you always on the food beat, or did you do something else first?
No. So I've been there 39 years. So I started in college. I was looking for a job to help me pay my rent and tuition. And actually, my older sister worked at the Tribune, and they needed somebody in the library. And so I got a job answering phones and then doing things that, you know, before the internet, I was an indexer, which I used to call the Google of the newsroom. You know, people would come to my desk and look on my Rolodex to find when articles ran and what page. And then I was a typist. And then after I graduated from college, I
began writing.
So I was a community reporter, covered, you know, Midvale and some of the southern towns in Salt Lake County before they were actually cities. And then I was an education writer for 11 years. I'd covered higher ed and public ed. And then in 2000, I got the food job.
You know, I think that people think of the food job as this sort of luxurious and fancy thing. I mean, and I'm wondering if there's a point at which you, I mean, you wanted the job, obviously, you applied for it.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm wondering if there was a point at which you were like, this isn't quite what I expected, or that you did recognize that you had this amazing job.
Yeah, you know, I always approached the food job as any reporter. I just always took it on as food as a story. So
yeah.
I interviewed, you know, the farmers who grew the food, the chefs who cooked the food.
Did you ever interview the food itself?
Yeah, it's hard to interview asparagus, you know. It doesn't really work. But that was the thing that attracted me to the beat was the people who were doing it. I mean, of course, I loved the food, right? It was fun to eat the food, right?
Yeah. Of course.
But
the people have stories.
But the people have stories. And so I always tried to approach my food writing as the people are the stories, and the food is just the benefit, right?
Yeah. So how much has the food and alcohol scene changed during your tenure on the food beat? I mean, is there an easy way to describe that?
I mean, I got to grow up with Utah's food scene is what I always tell people.
You mean like the training table?
The training table. I did. When I first started, I think we only had the downtown farmers market. And now, yeah. I mean, think how many markets we have. We only had two or three breweries, Squatters, Wasatch. I got to write about Epic. I mean, I got to write about every new brewery because it was exciting, right? We were getting new breweries.
Yeah.
I got to write about High West Distillery, the first distillery. Cremonelli Sausage, I got to write about him when he was just starting out in the basement of Caputo's.
Yeah.
I mean, so I got to, like, write about these people, you know, just as they were starting out. And now they're national companies, you know. And I always get to say, like, oh, I knew R&R Barbecue when they were still on the barbecue circuit, those two brothers.
Yeah.
And they told me when they were on the circuit, like, we're thinking of doing a restaurant. What do you think? Like, now R&R Barbecue, you know. So
it's huge. Yeah.
Yeah. So over 20 years, I feel like I got to introduce Utah to the new food scene.
What a cool gig. Today, as I look out, it seems like people go out a lot more to dine than they used to. Is that true?
Oh, yes, definitely. When I first started, my food section, Wednesday food section, was a lot of recipes, cooking, and that. And then over time, you know, the internet, you could get recipes on blogs, and, you know, and
yeah.
So, then it switched to, hey, we want to know where the best places to go are. What are the new places? And so my reporting kind of changed to become, hey, here's all the new restaurants, you know.
Yeah.
What's unique about them? What, you know, what...
Should you go?
Should you go? Yeah. I was never a restaurant reviewer.
Right.
I did, you know, oversee our reviewers and kind of point them to the restaurants that they would review. But I always say that was the funnest job. I got to go meet the chefs and not have to be anonymous. I got to go in and talk to them.
Right. You weren't a critic.
I wasn't a critic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you think is generally overpriced? You know what I mean? Like, why does this cost as much money as it does?
Well, no, yeah. I would say I don't know why people wait an hour and a half in line for food. Like, there's a lot of restaurants, right? And so, and why people are lining up at Texas Roadhouse and waiting for an hour and a half, I don't know that. Why do you do that? There are so many other restaurants. We need to kind of broaden our horizon. So I will not wait an hour and a half for food. I'm a Greek girl, so I got to eat fast, right? But, like, I always just think, well, no, I'm gonna go somewhere else, or I'll find another place that needs my money.
I'm wondering if in Utah we kind of, if we ever hit like peak restaurant, you know, like are we on the upslope still? Have we passed the point in time? Like, was 2008 the best time in Utah restaurant scene, and now there's, or is the best yet to come?
I don't know where the restaurants go after COVID. I feel like we were on the upswing. I think we had peaked. I mean, we had been in some national publications saying Utah's food scene is amazing. And then the pandemic hit, and I don't know. Maybe we bottomed out and we're on our way up for restaurants. I don't know what the pandemic has done to restaurants.
Okay.
Because they're still struggling out there. And starting new ones, there's plenty of people starting new ones. So it doesn't mean we're not interested in food. But I don't know where the scene is going. I do think the curve is less fine dining. I think it's a little more casual dining. You know, we want good food, but we don't want it in a fussy setting, right?
Yeah.
So, and maybe the pandemic did that to us. Maybe we were already headed there.
Is there anything that used to be around, Kathy, that isn't anymore? You know, places that used to be around, maybe it could be a restaurant, it could be one of those fine dining places that that went the way of, well, not the Dodo, but that went, you know, a certain way. Are there any restaurants or shacks or bars or whatever that you especially miss that at one point in time existed and now no longer exist?
Oh, you know, there's a lot of, like, old diners that maybe, you know, Lamb's is closed, Bill and Nada's is closed, and those were kind of the places of my youth, but they've closed because new people come up and want new things. I mean, I don't want to blame millennials because I'm the mother of two of them and I love them and they're great, but we have a short attention span. We like new things, you know, the hot restaurant and it's hot for a while and then we move on to the next thing. So I don't know. Social media has changed that, right? We're always looking for something new. What's the new restaurant? Because, you know, people are always asking me, what's the new restaurant? What's cool? So we're always kind of looking for something new and exciting. So
people want to be in the know.
Yeah. Huh. So, and so sometimes those older restaurants get tired and maybe they don't change with the times. And so that's why they close.
Okay. Well, I'm with you on those. I mean, there's like the nostalgia too, right? Like for Bilanetas and for Lamb's, the idea that you could get those dishes that you always could rely on to be exactly the same.
But then there's other restaurants that have endured, and so you know, I don't know. Before the pandemic, I wrote a story about, you know, why restaurants close. There's so many reasons why restaurants close. It's not really always about the food. So sometimes it's your landlord is selling the building and putting in an apartment complex.
And there's no place for you to go that's easy to...
Yes. So, I mean, so there's so many things that restaurants close for.
Right.
So.
And you can't necessarily just blame the food decisions or whatever.
No.
Alcohol laws changed, but the bar scene has changed significantly in Utah.
Yeah, I mean, I think liquor laws in the 20 years that I was covering it changed a lot. I mean, no more private clubs.
Yeah.
Right? That went away during the Olympics.
Can you sponsor me? I need to come in and get a drink. Yeah.
No more private clubs. That was a great change. The Zion Curtain Law changed, went down, right? That was a big thing that changed. Yeah. Of course, the needle swings the other way, and the DUI law became tougher.
Yeah.
So liquor laws are always changing and maneuvering, and they're just interesting in Utah. We're always going to have that dynamic where people want to drink and the state is the monopoly.
Right.
And that presents all sorts of interesting dynamics. But
And getting those licenses is kind of an interesting process.
Getting the licenses. You know, why is it so hard to get a bar license? Why is there a quota? Why is there a population quota in Utah? Ben and I on our Booze News podcast was always say it's a artificial limit. You know, 10,200 for every 10,200 people, we get one bar license. But that could be changed. You don't have to have that. And why is it that amount? So, but there are other good things about that. You know, we don't have some of the over drinking problems that other states do. So, you know, it's a little fine line everybody has to walk.
All right.
It's fun to be a journalist and write about it.
What should an aspiring food writer do? If somebody out there is listening, they're like, gosh, Kathy had such a cool gig. And again, there may be parts of it that were not as glamorous as people think.
Yeah.
But you know, let's say that somebody wants to be a food writer.
What
advice?
To do? What, yeah. Any advice for aspiring food writers?
Write about food.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it goes back to how I kind of said I did my stories. I always was more interested in writing about the place, or that maybe they were in a historic building, or the person who was cooking had this great story, or the farm had been, you know, yeah. I always tried to find, I mean, the food is always important, but the people behind it and the place are really part of the food to me. So, you know, always kind of be looking for those things.
That's cool.
You know,
yeah.
I was never one to, like, you know, eat something and pontificate about, you know, like, and I always tell people, everybody's a really good judge of food. You eat food every day. So when you taste it, you know, do you like it? Is it good? What do you like about it? Just think about what it is you like. What is it? Everybody has different tastes too. So just because I like it, it's okay. If you do and I don't, I'm not gonna, you know, yeah. You maybe there's nostalgia there for you that I don't see. Everybody has different food memories. You know, I grew up kind of on a farm, and so I have different food memories than maybe you did if you grew up in a city. And you know, food is memories too, right? I mean, so you might like something, and maybe I think it's terrible, but your grandma made it, and that brings back love to you. So food is so many different things to people. And that is one thing I do think food has become, too, is it can be politics. I mean, how we raise our food. It can be political. It can be environmental, right? Cattle and
how far away the food comes
from. How far away the food comes from. So I think when I first started 20 years ago, that wasn't always in the picture. And now as we kind of evolve, food is seen as, you know, environment and politics. And that is an exciting place to go for food. Mm.
There's this article that Courtney Tanner wrote about you, about the clippings that she saved of articles that you had written. She's now, you know, one of your colleagues at the Tribune, or she was because you've retired. Did you ever think that you were having that kind of impact on people?
You forget, right? You forget, you know, in the daily newspaper grind, you're just trying to get your stories out and get them on time and get photos. And you forget that maybe there is an eighth grader out there clipping your stories. So it makes you proud of what you've done. At least, you know, she saved them. It's like, okay, I must have done an okay job.
I love it.
Yeah. And it's fun because Courtney's kind of an up-and-coming reporter, and we have many in the Tribune newsroom, and so I feel blessed to be leaving the newsroom to them because I think it is in good hands.
What are you going to miss, and what are you going to do?
Oh, miss. You know, there is nothing like being in a newsroom. Mm. And what I've always loved about my job was going out on assignment, finding a story, interviewing the farmer and going out with the photographer and, you know, spending 2 or 3 hours out there or going in a kitchen. Really, the part of the job that I loved was interviewing and getting the notes. The hard part was always going back to my computer and going, oh, now what do I write? You know, the writing was the hard part. Yeah. So I will definitely miss going out on assignment, finding new restaurants, meeting new people, and hanging out with my colleagues at the Salt Lake Tribune. They're the best. So that's what I will miss. What am I going to do? I'm going to do whatever I want. My husband and I have worked a long time, and he retired in July, so, you know, there's a few little travel trips, and I don't know. We'll figure it out.
You'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if you'll just keep doing it. You know, you'll keep going out on assignment, but you just won't have to do the hard work of writing the story after.
I won't have to go to a restaurant and think, should I write a story about this place? Yeah.
That's very cool. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm tempted to ask you about where people should go right now and all sorts of stuff, but
I'll tell you, I'm excited about, it's called Fenice. It's on Regent Street, and they're the same people who own Silver Star Cafe in Park City.
Oh, yeah.
So it's behind the Eccles Theater. So I'm excited to try that restaurant. So that's my new place I want to try.
Kathy Stevenson, again, congratulations on an amazing career, and we're so lucky to have had you bringing us the food scene in Utah for as long as you've been doing it, and appreciate your reporting. Thanks for coming in and talking to us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course.
And again, that's Kathy Stevenson with the Tribune, and our congratulations to Kathy once more on her retirement. She will be missed, as will her reporting. Since we have just a little bit more time in the show, I will plug another program that KCPW put together this week. 70 years ago, the U.S. government began a series of above-ground atomic and nuclear tests at the Nevada test site, about 60 miles northwest of Las Vegas. And from 1951 until 1962, at least 100 devices were detonated in the atmosphere at the facility. This week on In the Hive, we talked to Mary Dixon, who is a proponent for downwinders and an advocate, journalist, and playwright. You can hear that conversation and a little bit of history of America's nuclear testing program over at kcpw.org. That's also where you can find all of our local programs, including this show. And that does it for Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Again, podcasts at kcpw.org. Find all of the reporting that you heard on the program over at sltrib.com. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great weekend, and join us again next week.